the tabernacle. The old Israelite tent of worship for 480 years, from the time of Moses to when Solomon built the temple, the tabernacle. We're working our way through the wilderness with the Israelites, and Moses went up on top of the mountain, and God said, go back down and tell them not to touch the mountain. And Moses said, they're not going to touch the mountain. They're scared to death. And God said, go down and tell them. So Moses went up and down, and then Moses went back up. And he got some of the law when he went back up, and he came back down, and they had the old covenant where they promised to keep God's law. And then Moses went back up the mountain. He came down and went up more than once. He went back up the mountain, and God was giving him lots of things. And in that period of time, God told him how to build the tabernacle. It was probably from about chapter 25 to about chapter 30 or 31 in the book of Exodus. Lots of chapters on the details of the tabernacle. We kind of skipped those chapters, and we jumped all into Moses being on the mountain, and God suddenly is very much angered. He sends Moses back down. He said, go down to thy people. As if they're not my people anymore, says God. They were worshiping the golden calf. You remember Moses comes back down. And we talked about that time when he came down and he interceded for them. And God had mercy. He even showed his face to Moses. And then we talked about God covered in the Old Testament where Moses' face was covered. And the veil covered God. All manner of coverings in the Old Testament that are now revealed in the New Testament. And then we proceed on in our book of Exodus. And we come to chapter 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, where it goes through in those chapters and basically says the same things that it said way back there in chapter 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, and maybe 31. Where in those earlier chapters he had said, you make the tabernacle this way. And in those last six or seven chapters it says they made the tabernacle this way. And at that point, I wonder to myself, why did God spend six or seven chapters saying the same thing again? Except in the first section, he said, you make it this way. And in the second section, it said they made it, but not just say made it this way. It could have easily, they could have eliminated six or seven chapters and said they made it as Moses had told them to make it. But that's not what happened. He goes through the whole thing about the tabernacle again. All the details. All the little minute details. Of how you'd build it. And how big it would be. And just how it would be laid out. And all these details that are quite honestly, it was a great work of architecture and engineering. It was a super great work of craftsmanship for that day especially. It was a reality that they built it. But there's so much symbolism in the building of it and how it looks and how it's made. So that God went through it all twice. And I thought to myself, if God went through it twice, maybe we ought to go through it once. Sorry, God, we shouldn't have skipped that maybe. So now as we come to it the second time, we're going to go through the tabernacle. We won't scratch the surface of it. All the details and all the symbolism. I'll tell you what, you can get lost in the measurements of it, but it fit together like a puzzle. It's amazing the measurements and how God said to make it. But when you start running the math, it works. I'm not an architect and I'm not an engineer, but the numbers add up. And this thing measured in the pieces that God said to measure this way, and then hook that to that and this to this, and it would work, and it did work. And it worked for 480 years, apparently. That's a pretty good building, isn't it? Well, it wasn't even really a building. It was sort of a tent. Wouldn't you like to get something that lasts 480 years these days? Wouldn't you like to have something built that well? Let's talk about the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 35, verse 5. Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. Whosoever it is of a willing heart, let him bring it an offering of the Lord, gold and silver and brass, and blue and purple and scarlet, and fine linen and goat's hair, and ram's skins dyed red, and badger's skins, and shittim wood, and it goes on. Jewels and precious stones and other things, if you have it and of a willing mind and want to bring it, come give it to the building of the house of the Lord. And the people came and the people gave. Those that were of a willing mind and a willing heart, they made an offering of what they had. How did they get all this stuff? You remember they spoiled Egypt? As if they won the war, they took from Egypt the riches and carried those riches with them. And now God says, I want some of your riches to build a tent of worship. And they come willingly and freely and cheerfully giving to the Lord. You know, we fussed at them so far. At the bank of the Red Sea, they got all tore up and said, why'd you even bring us out of Egypt? And when they were running short on water, when they didn't have the food and all the other things, they've been complainers and murmurers. And they've danced before the golden calf, but now they're willing givers, cheerful givers. I like that. Verse 21, and they came, everyone whose heart stirred him up, and everyone whom his spirit made willing, and they brought the Lord's offering to the work. The heart stirred him up. You think that's the old heart? The carnal, sinful, fleshy heart? Or do you think that might be a born-again heart? And what spirit do you think this might be working in their hearts? Is it the evil spirit of carnality, or is it a good spirit of God that's within them? I believe they're listening to the voice from God within them. Their hearts are willing, they're stirred up, their spirits are willing, and they brought the Lord's offering to the work. Verse 25, and all the women that were wise-hearted did spin with their hands both of blue and of purple and of scarlet and of fine linen, and all the women whose hearts stirred them up in wisdom spun goat's hair. All right, their hearts stirred them up to give what they had, and their hearts stirred them up to work. You know, sometimes rich folks aren't very talented, but they've got riches to give. And sometimes poor folks don't have much riches, but they got some talents to give. There's a couple of ways you can give. You can give if you can spin goat's hair and make it into a big curtain. Or you can spin if you've got some goat's hair and give it to the cause. And I expect some of them gave it to the cause and then did some time spinning. So here they are. They're willing to work and they're willing to give. That's a good combination for a group of God's followers. Verse 2 of chapter 36. Moses called every wise-hearted man in whose heart the Lord had put wisdom, even everyone whose heart stirred him up, to come into the work to do it. God had given some of these men natural abilities. These women could spin and turn it into cloth, turn threads into cloth. And these men could, they were craftsmen. A God-given ability that he put upon them, and they had a willing, stirred-up heart to come and want to work for the Lord. Verse 5, and they spake unto Moses, saying, these are the leaders of the building of this thing. They speak unto Moses, saying, the people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded to make. I kind of like that, too. Whoever's keeping the purse, and whoever's in charge of collecting all the gold to make all this stuff that's going to need to be made out of gold. And there was a lot of stuff. They needed a lot of gold, but they had enough. And you know what some folks might have thought about doing at that point? Folks that aren't thinking like these folks are thinking. Just let them keep on bringing it. I could put some under my bed. I could stick some in my pocket. Just keep bringing it. Come on, boys, and bring some more. Sometimes that kind of attitude kills churches, doesn't it? Give, give, give. When they had enough, they had enough. Enough's enough. You keep the rest of it, it's yours. Good attitude by the ones receiving what's being given. And Moses gave commandment, and the people were restrained from bringing. Not only the leaders and the workers, Moses also. A man of God, a man after God's teachings, and a man who would follow God's ways. He directs everybody, enough's enough, don't bring any more. So we just pick up a few little details there. In the time that they're gathering together and getting the material together and making the cloths and those kind of things. So let's get into this thing, the tabernacle itself. Let's do a little explaining before we start, because wherever you start with this thing, if you start with the framework, you're not going to understand that it's a tent. And if you start with just the cloth, you're not going to understand how the framework. So I'm going to kind of describe the tabernacle a little bit. It was a tent, but it had a walled frame around it, with the tent that draped over the top that was made up of several layers. It had two rooms in it. The full dimension of the tabernacle, it was 15 feet wide, and it was 45 feet long, and it was like a cave. One end of it was open. The end that faced the east was open, and there was not a wall there. The other three sides, the far end of it and the two sides of it, the long sides, were made up of boards that were covered with this cloth and these materials they were putting together. So it's got a frame, but it is a tent. And the dimensions of the tent was actually would be divided off into two portions. The front room of the tent, which it eventually would have a door on this open end, but the front room of it was twice as large as the back room. Both rooms were the full width, 15 feet, but the front room was 30 feet long, and the back room was a square, 15 by 15. So that's kind of, if you can get a picture in your mind of how it's shaped, it's got two rooms, a back small square room, and a front rectangle room that's twice as large as the back room, and it's kind of three-sided as far as the walls of it, and the front end will have a drape over it to cover the entrance. Now, having that mental picture, let's begin where the Bible begins here and talk about the coverings of that tabernacle, that tent. What would make the tent part of it? Tents are made out of cloth or out of something flexible, and you drape the top of a tent over. Okay, the covering of 10 curtains that were cunning work of linen cloth. Exodus 36 and 8. And every wise-hearted man among them that wrought, that is, that worked the work of the tabernacle, made 10 curtains of fine twined linen, and blue and purple and scarlet, with cherubims of cunning work made he them. So we've got the women, and they're making these cloths, these big curtains, these huge pieces of material. And the men are working on them, and the talented people, men or women, are embroidering this thing with cherubims. And it's got all these different colored threads woven through it. And it's a beautiful piece of cloth. And it's quite large. It really is. We're not talking about grandma making a quilt. We're talking about a great big piece of material right here. The length of one curtain was 28 cubits. Now we're going to take the more common measure for a cubit. There's a little disagreement among scholars as to exactly how long a cubit was, but most say a cubit was 18 inches. If a cubit is 18 inches, and the length of one curtain was 28 cubits, that's 14 yards long, 42 feet. 42 feet long, this curtain. And the breadth of one curtain was 4 cubits, that's 2 yards, 6 feet wide. The curtains were all of one size, 10 curtains, all of them 42 feet long and 6 feet wide. And he coupled 5 curtains one unto another, and the other 5 curtains he coupled one unto another. Lay these curtains out 42 feet long ways, and lay 5 of them down side by side. And you couple 5 of them together. You're going to make this thing into one monster curtain. With 5 of those hooked together, you come to the dimensions. It's 14 yards, 42 feet long, and 10 yards, 30 feet wide. That's one, and you've got 2 of those. Great big curtains. Take a lot of men around the edge. They have to even pick it up, wouldn't it? Much less hoist it up on top of this frame that they're going to build. So they've got these 2 curtains that are made like this, and they're for the covering. They're beautiful. They're beautiful. But they'll not be able to be seen from the outside. They'll be beautiful only on the inside, really. Just wait and see how it comes about here. Even the beautiful curtains are covered from the outside. But on the inside, you're seeing all this fine needlework and this fine twined linen and all this blue and purple and scarlet colors and the cherubims woven into it. And he made loops of blue on the edge of one curtain in the coupling. Likewise, he made in the uttermost side of another curtain in the coupling of the second.
50 loops made he in one curtain, and 50 loops made he in the edge of the second curtain, in the coupling of the second. The loops held one curtain to another, and he made 50 tatches, those are knobs or buttons, of gold, and coupled the curtains one to another with the tatches, so it became one tabernacle. Okay, now we talked about laying these 5 curtains out side by side. And in the edge, where they're going to join to each other, there's got to be a seam there. They made loops. Loops of cloth. And then they made tatches. As we'd use the word attach, these tatches attach the two cloths. You've got 50 loops coming out on this side, on each side of them, coming out side by side, and 50 loops on these two over here, and 50 loops on down there. And then each one of those loops, you could put 2 loops together, and you put within that loop one of these tatches that would attach them together. It's like a button. As I'm thinking about this, I'm having to use a bit of imagination, but you got a loop here and a loop here, and you're going to get those 2 loops tied together, and I think about a cuff link. And maybe that's not a good illustration because you hardly see cuff links anymore, but back in the good old days, a real fancy shirt, it didn't have a button right here. It had 2 holes right there. And through those 2 holes, you'd put this cuff link thing, and it would snap, flip open, and it would attach it together, 2 loops attached together with a button in between or a knob or a pin or something like that. So now that's how they hook them all together, and eventually they're going to hook the 2 big ones together when they put it across the top of this thing. So you've got these beautiful curtains, but we're going to cover them up with goat's hairs curtains. I bet these aren't as pretty. Can you imagine a goat's hair curtain? It doesn't have the cunning work. It doesn't have the cherubims. It's not colorful. It's just goat's hair woven together, made into cloth. The covering of 11 goat's hair curtains. Verse 7, chapter 26. We're going back to 26. And thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair to be a covering over the tabernacle. 11 curtains shalt thou make. One more curtain with the goat's hair than with the pretty linen. The length of one curtain shall be 30 cubits, 15 yards, where the others had been just 42 feet. These are 45, 1 yard longer. The length of one curtain shall be 30 cubits, 15 yards, and the breadth of one curtain, again, 40 cubits, 2 yards, and the 11 curtains shall be all of one measure. Make them all the same size, but now you've got 11 of these. And you hook 5 of them together, and you hook the other 6 of them together. You've got an odd number. And one of these big quilts, these big curtains, is going to be one width wider than the smaller one. One of them has 5 panels, another one has 6 panels. And thou shalt couple 5 curtains by themselves. That'll make 15 yards by 10 yards, 45 feet by 30 feet. And 6 curtains by themselves, 15 yards by 12 yards, that's 45 feet by 36 feet. And thou and shalt double the 6th curtain in the forefront of the tabernacle. As you lay these, drape these over the tabernacle, these curtains, there's going to be an extra length here, and you're going to drape it over the front. Remember we told you the front of it's kind of open? This is the starting of the covering of the front. You'll drape it over, and then you'll lay it back on itself. And I read one scholar who described it as the veil on the bride's face, that this kind of covered it and framed it like a veil would a bride's face. This one that had been folded back and hanging down, but yet folded back a double thickness there, hanging over the front edge. And thou shalt couple 5 curtains and 6 curtains, and the remnant that remaineth of the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that remaineth, shall hang over the back side of the tabernacle. Come over the back side and drape down to the ground there. And a cubit on the one side and a cubit on the other side that remaineth it shall hang over the sides of the curtain to cover it. So now, we're going to have a frame, and we're going to lay these first 2 beautiful curtains over. Great big ones, but they're laid across this thing. And then we're going to lay the goat's hair curtains on top of them. And remember, they're just a little bit longer. And so they're going to hang just a little bit farther over. So you're not even going to get to see the edge of that pretty one from the outside. It's going to be covered. You know, sometimes you got to get inside the church to see the pretty part, don't you? We tend to make the outside of our buildings real pretty, and that's okay. I'm not knocking that, but But this wasn't made for beauty for the outside. It pictures beauty on the inside. And it pictures church in so many ways, and I think this is just one picture of church here, that on the inside is where the real beauty is. To the world, the outside will look right plain, and maybe they'd even say that's ugly. But on the inside, you get to see the real church. So now we've got the inside, but you know, when this thing ends up, it's a picture of the church, but it's dark in there. There's no windows in this structure here. There's no windows. There's one lamp, seven candelabra kind of lamp, and there's nothing in that second room to get off any light. So it's real pretty, but really nobody can see it. Even the priests that come in there, it's so dim that they're missing most of the beauty. And I think, in a sense, that the Old Testament worship missed a lot of beauty that's in the New Testament. They saw it, but they kind of saw it darkly and kind of dimly, and rather in the shadows instead of the brilliance of New Testament revelation with Christ. So we've got pictures, I think, of the beauty, but we've got pictures, again, of the beauty kind of hidden. We talked about last week that the Old Testament had the glory covered, and here we have it again. So we've got these 11 curtains and the 10 curtains on the inside, but then that's not all the coverings. Verse 19, chapter 36, and he made a covering for the tent of ram's skins dyed red, and a covering of badger skins above that. Now, unless you're into trapping, and I'm not knocking trapping, skins aren't the most beautiful things in the world, and I'll bet you a badger skin's not overly impressive, or a ram skin. But these are the coverings above everything. And maybe this gave it some waterproofing and some things that away. But above it all, we've got two layers of skins that I suppose are tied together. There's not much directions on the skins. At some places it says that Moses was to make it as the pattern he saw in the mountain. So we'll just assume God told him how to do that, but it's not written down here. Now then, we've talked about the covering, but we haven't talked about what the covering goes over. So let's build the frame now, or let's see how they built the frame. And this just blows my mind, the craftsmanship involved in this part. Now, the making of the curtains, maybe I'm not a seamstress, and I don't appreciate all the work in making a 42-foot-long curtain or a 45-foot-long curtain. But I can appreciate some of this woodwork here. I'm not a craftsman that way, but I've been around it enough that I know this took some real wisdom and some real skills and a real hand of God guiding them, I do believe. And I think about this at some point in this story as we'll get to it, and I'll think, there's no way they could have done that. Then I think about Moses and his three sons building an ark, and I think, there's no way they could have done that. But they did it under God's strength and with God's wisdom, and these men did too. So I've kind of set the stage here for this frame, and let's read about it and see how it was put together. He made boards for the tabernacle of shittim wood standing up. Upright boards out in the middle of the desert. What are you going to do with an upright board out in the middle of the desert? What makes boards stay upright? Well, that's the problem with building a house. You got to get the walls to go up and stay up and not blow down. How would you do that out there with the materials that they have? So they start out, the boards are described. He made boards for the tabernacle of shittim wood standing up. The length of a board was 10 cubits, 5 yards, 15 feet. 15 feet tall. That's a tall board. That's a long board to stand up out there and expect it to stay standing. The length of the board was 10 cubits, 5 yards, and the breadth of a board was 1 cubit and a half. That's 3/4 of a yard, 27 inches. So you've got a 27-inch board. Well, that's a 27-inch board, 15 feet high. And you've got a bunch of these. They make a bunch of them. They make them where they'll stand side by side, down each side, and across each end. But boards don't stand on their own. How are they going to get them to stand up? Here we go. They make all these boards. The one board had two tenons. The end of a timber fitted for insertion is what that is. You got this board. It's 27 inches wide. On the bottom of that board, it's got two prongs sticking out. We'll call them prongs. Doesn't describe how big they all were. Doesn't describe how they were shaped. But they're made to be inserted into a socket. They'll make bases out of metal, out of silver, that these extensions off these boards, these tenons that stick down, will stick down in the sockets and, so to speak, snap in there. Sort of like Legos, you know. And there's two prongs sticking down. There's going to be two holes down there that those are going to go into. So now that's the start of how it's going to all look together. Each of these boards, they have to design these things just right. I don't know if they carved them out with pocket knives. Well, they didn't have pocket knives, did they? I don't know what they had. But they've got a nice shaped board here that they didn't have power saws to cut down the tree. And they didn't have table saws. And they didn't have planes. And they didn't have anything. But they made these boards. And they're all shaped the same. It was like a stack of timber you'd go to Lowe's and get. And all these boards designed and polished up and looking good, they're going to end up covered with gold. Every board covered with gold. But now you got these boards, you got these two pegs coming off the bottom of each board. That's where we are so far. And he made 20 boards. That's 3/4 of a yard times 20 yards. That's 15 yards for the south side. And 40 sockets, that's the bases. He made those of silver. He made under the 20 boards, two sockets under one board for his two tenons, and two sockets under another board for his two tenons. So now you've got these sockets. They're silver. They've been cast down to silver, and they're probably pretty good-sized chunks of silver with these legs coming off of them, is the way I visualize them. It's not all the details are given, but you've got these things running crossways, and you've got a socket there that tenon's going to go in, and you put two of these crossways, and then you turn that board, and you put it down in those two. So you got like four legs coming out, one up, two up this way, and two down this way, holding up that one board. So now you got a whole row of boards with all these sockets underneath them and these tenons, and they've snapped them in, and they're all standing there. But it's still a pretty shaky wall, and kind of a wavy wall, I've got a feeling. What's tying each board together with the next board? We're coming to that. So you put 40 sockets on the south side, and you put 20 boards and 40 sockets on the north side, and on the west side it's shorter, and you just put six boards there, but you'll have two. The corner's real fancy. I love the corner. I have to study on the corner a while. I'm not sure I've got it, but what I think they do on the corner, you got six boards that make up the wall, and you still got a little space if you run the math. That doesn't hardly make the distance, but eight boards is a little bit too far. So what they're doing on this end down here, and you got these two end boards that are going to make up a corner, and these two walls coming down towards those corners, and the wall butts in to the end, to the side of the end board, and makes a T there. And then they've got a ring that goes on the top and a ring that goes on the bottom that'll clinch this T together and make a solid corner. You know, you need a cornerstone if you're going to have a good, strong building. And it describes how the cornerstones are made, and I'm not sure I'm following, but I think that basically is the way it is. And they've got eight sockets under this corner with the two boards coming together in a T and these rings on top and bottom that are holding these together. I'm kind of leaving my text and just describing this thing. So it makes a perfect dimension. When you do the math, it comes out just right that they've got the right dimension for the width of it and the length of it is good and they've got all these boards, but then what's going to hold it all together? So far, it's just individual boards except for those two corners that are solidly hooked to each other. Let me find where we are here. And he made bars of shittim wood, five for the boards of the one side, and five bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and five bars for the boards of the tabernacle for the sides westward. That's the end. The end has five bars. The two sides have five bars. What are you going to do with these bars? He made the middle bar, listen to this, he made the middle bar to shoot through the boards from the one end to the other. And he overlaid the boards with gold and made their rings of gold to be places for the bars and overlaid the bars with gold. The best I can determine, and I tried to read some commentaries and some scholars to see if I was plumb off base here, and it seems that most agree this is the way it was. You've got all these boards that are coming down this wall and then they're sort of just out there floating around. They're standing now. They've got sockets to stand on and the tenons in the socket, but what's going to tie them all together to make a solid wall? They attach rings, two rows of rings up high and two rows of rings down low, a ring on every board. And they've got a rod that they run through those rings, and I've got a feeling it was a tight fit, and that sort of tied it together, but the middle rod on the south wall and the north wall, those two long walls, and the west wall, the shorter wall, the middle board, let me read it again. The middle board, he made the middle board to shoot through the boards from the one end to the other. I wouldn't want that job if I had a drill press. I can see some of you guys grinning. Can you imagine getting these boards out there in the middle of nowhere where you don't have a good solid surface to even lay them on and get it where that hole matches up all 20 boards and each one of those 27 inches wide? We're not told how thick they are. I don't know that. It's not given. We don't know if they were that wide or that wide. But still, to drill a hole all the way through the middle of that board and that board and that board and that board and have them match up so perfectly that you can take a rod and slide it through the whole length of the wall, 45 feet, and that tied the wall together. That and the rings with the other poles, the other bars coming through, and that thing's tied together out there in the middle of nowhere. You've got a three-sided structure with two solid corners and five bars on each of these walls to hook it all together. I believe it would have been better than a frame 2x4 wall. If you could do that kind of craftsmanship and hook it up with that kind of precision, that thing would have been almost like concrete, I believe. And it must have been. Reckon they ever faced some storms out there with that thing? We've got storms that blow houses off the foundation. That thing lasted 480 years. What construction? What engineering? What craftsmanship? What a building! I can just, without any symbolism or any picture of Christ, and we've got pictures of strength. We've got pictures of everything tied together perfectly and all manner of spiritual pictures of Christ, but just the ingenuity and the craftsmanship and the workmanship and the skills of those men to put that thing together. I'll take my hat off to them. They could do it without tools, like we call tools. I bought a saw here a while back, and I was showing a real kind of contracting kind of guy my new saw, and he laughed at it. He said, "You call that a saw? I thought it was a pretty good saw for me." What kind of tools do you think they had back then compared to what a contractor would have now? Nothing. But I'll bet their skill levels were better than anybody around. Good hands. They had good hands and a good heart and good mind and willing to work. They put this thing together. So then, now you've got it framed up and you've got the curtain to go across the frame. It's coming together here. But you've still got the two veils. The veil between the two rooms and the door that would enter into the whole thing. "And thou shalt make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet, fine twined linen of cunning work, with cherubims shall it be made. And thou shalt hang up the veil under the taches, and that thou mayest bring in thither within the veil the ark of the testimony, and the veil shall divide unto you between the holy place and the most holy place." This is what's going to make the partition between the rooms. This is the interior wall. It'll turn the one room into two rooms, one small room toward the back and a large room toward the front. Something that's really interesting here, and we won't take the time to go through it. If you take those two curtain veils, you know, they're the same dimension, 10 curtains and all of them coming out the same. And if you'll take one of those curtains, start on this back wall down where it would come to, down next to the ground, and bring it up that back wall and over the edge, it's going to come exactly 15 feet over the top of the tabernacle frame. And then that leaves you 30 feet up here this way that other curtain's going to put, cover that part. But where's the seam where those two curtains were attached together? Where's that seam? It's exactly in the place where the veil will hang from that seam where those attaches are. That makes a hanging rod for the veil to come down. It's made just right. Sometimes I start out with a project and have to start over because I didn't think about that. That's typical for me trying to build something, but this is thought out. So that seam becomes the top to hang the veil from. So they make this beautiful veil and they hang it in that place, one third of the way from the back and 2/3 from the front. There hangs that veil. And thou shalt make a hanging for the door of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen wrought with needlework. And thou shalt make for the hanging five pillars of shittim wood and overlay them with gold, and their hooks shall be of gold and five sockets of brass. So you've got these boards that are overlaid with gold, and you've got the whole thing covered where you really can't even see those boards, but they're pretty underneath there. And that's the tent of worship. Now, the furnishings of that tent were few. The pieces for worship were few. Behind the veil, not the door veil, the door into the first room, into the second room, and that veil into the holiest of all, the only thing that's back there is the Ark of the Covenant and its covering called the mercy seat. That's what's behind the veil. One piece of furniture. Inside that ark, there's the Ten Commandments, the two tables of stone. And inside that ark is where they put the pot of manna that they'd collected. And they ended up putting Moses' rod in there that had budded. So sometimes that ark had this or that in it. But that's the only piece of furnishing back there is the ark and the mercy seat upon it. Bezaleel, he's one of the craftsmen, made the ark of shittim wood, 2 cubits and a half, 45 inches, was the length of it, and a cubit and a half, 27 inches the breadth and the height. It's a box. It's a box without a top on it. And it's so long, and it's so wide, and about so tall. It's covered with gold inside and outside. And they make the lid for that box, and that's what's called the mercy seat. The lid to the box has a name, the mercy seat. He overlaid it with pure gold within and without. And he cast for it 4 rings of gold to be set on the 4 corners of it. And he made staves of shittim wood and overlaid them with gold. That's how you carried these furnishings. Each one would have rings of gold on the corners. And you put a pole, a rod through it, and it's overlaid with gold. And the priest would carry it up on their shoulders when they moved it. Remember, this thing's mobile. You can take it down and put it up. It wasn't like they built a foundation and set it there to last forever. It would move down the road a little bit. And then it would set for a while. And then it would move again. And they could take it down and put it up. But when they carried it on their shoulders, the Ark of the Covenant. And he put the staves into the rings of the sides of the ark to bear the ark. And he made the mercy seat of pure gold. And he made 2 cherubims of gold on the 2 ends of the mercy seat. And the cherubims spread out their wings on high and covered with their wings over the mercy seat with their faces one to another. I don't know what a cherubim is. I assume angel, but I don't know. Ezekiel describes a creature that seems to be a cherubim, that's what he calls it. And his cherubim had 4 faces. The one of an ox, the one of a lion, the one of an eagle, and the one of a man. But these cherubim seem to just have 2 faces because their faces look to each other across the ark. So I don't know exactly what it was, but it's carved out this out of this mercy seat, these 2 cherubims with their wings spread and touching each other in the middle. I suppose one wing touching another wing, and their faces looking to the middle. And who's on the mercy seat? Whose seat is it? It's God's seat. And these cherubims, whatever they are, we'll think of them as angels perhaps, and their face is toward God as he sits on the mercy seat. And the mercy seat covers the ark, and inside the ark is God's law. And the mercy seat covers God's law. There's a picture in that, folks. It's God covering the law. That's the only way we can get to where God is. He was behind the veil and nobody could even come in there where he was. But as he's in there, he's covering the mercy seat. That Ark of the Covenant represents Jesus Christ. And inside that ark is where the law is kept. Did Jesus keep the law? He sure did. Did the Ark of the Covenant keep the law? It sure did. There's all any piece of this furnishings you look at, you can see Jesus pictured. In multiple ways. We don't have time to scratch the surface. I have no idea of the depth of the symbolism, just of the Ark of the Covenant, or just of the mercy seat. Now that's what's behind the veil to the most holy place, and then in that front room. Now only the high priest could go behind that veil once a year. But into the front room, the priest could come daily, ministering to the things of the temple, the tabernacle. And in this room, this front room, this larger room, there's a candlestick. It's really fancy. It's got 3 branches coming out on each side, something similar to a stand in the middle of it, and the stand has lamps on it, and there's knobs, and there's almond-shaped dishes in it, and there's flowers on it, and all this stuff in this candlestick. And it's got all these arms, and each arm is exactly the same, and the flowers are exactly the same, and every branch is made the same, but I want to tell you how they made it. Here we see some craftsmanship again. It was all made out of one 120-pound, one talent weight of gold. They didn't melt it. They didn't cast it as you'd melt metal and cast it into a form that you designed. They took hammers, and they started beating on a block of gold, and they made a candlestick with seven arms and with flowers, and each arm looking the same, each arm having the same dimension, and all the flowers exactly the same. How about I give you a hammer and a rock? See what you can turn that rock into. That's awesome, folks. That's quite a workman in gold right there that could come out of this block of gold. I once heard it said of one of the great sculptors, and he had a horse that he'd sculpted, and somebody said, "How did you do that?" He said, "Well, I just took off everything that didn't look like a horse." That sounds simple, doesn't it? But you start out with a block of wood and you just take off everything that didn't look like a horse, and there you got a horse. Can you imagine taking off everything that didn't look like these branches of this candelabra coming out? Or can you imagine taking that one block and keeping, if you keep beating gold, it'll keep getting thinner and thinner and thinner. You can mash it out and shape it with hammers. It's that kind of soft metal. But it sure would take a lot of precision blows, wouldn't it, to get this thing shaped like that. So they made the candelabra, the candle, to put some light, some dim light, and then the priest trimmed that daily. And they had a table out there, and the table was of certain dimensions. And on the table was the showbread and the utensils that they would need. And right in the center, they had the candelabra. As you walked in from the east end, the candle was on the south, which that would be to your right, and the table would be to your left if you were the priest coming in. And right in front of the veil was the incense altar, where they burned an exact mixture of spices, and nobody could use those spices for any other thing. If you wanted to get smelling good going on a date, you better not use that mixture right there, because God said don't do it. So I had this perfect mixture of incense and this oil that was mixed in a perfect way, and all these sweet odors coming up like the prayers of the saints before God of the incense. Now that's what was in the first room as you come in from the outside. And only the priest could go in there. The common folks couldn't go in, but yet there was still something for the common folks. Surrounding this whole frame tent thing in the middle was a courtyard. And the courtyard had a curtain coming around it, and it had posts, so to speak, spaced out the right dimension. It was 150 feet long and 150 feet on both sides and 75 feet on the two ends, and it had a fancy opening and a gate coming into it, the courtyard. Now, it wasn't covered. It just kind of a fence around this whole thing. And they had the post, and then they had fillets, they called them, and those were the rails on the post, and they hung curtains on those, but these curtains didn't seem to be so fancy. They didn't have all the carvings except for the front entrance at the east, and there was a fancy gate carved, a drape over the gate with curtains on it. On the front end, there was like, I think it was 15 feet on each side and a 20-foot opening. I don't remember my dimensions right exactly, but you had this gate to come into the courtyard, and the people could come into the courtyard. And thus was the tabernacle in the day of Moses and in the day of Joshua. And it went on through the judges and through David's days until Solomon built the temple. As we've talked about these things, let's close out with a little more talking about Christ. A little comparison between those Old Testament things and what Hebrews says and how it compares these things to New Testament. The Lord had spoken unto Moses and told him not to let Aaron go behind that veil except once a year with just the right kind of blood, lest he die. The tabernacle in so many ways was
was a picture of God being off limits. And the veil covered him, the darkness covered him, and you couldn't go in there, and he was just not accessible, it seems like. And he really wasn't. He was their God, but they couldn't get to where he was, and had really not that privilege. It was kind of more of a fear worship, perhaps. You better not go in there lest you die, as opposed to come unto me and I'll give you rest, kind of New Testament thinking. When Jesus died on the cross, the veil was torn from top to bottom, it says in the Gospels. If it was torn from top to bottom, that's the veil that separated the two rooms. The veil into that most holy place that had made it off limits to God, suddenly it's been torn at the death of Jesus from top to the bottom. God's up on top, and he tore it from top to bottom. And that signifies access now. That the veil is removed, and we can come right straight to the mercy seat, to the throne of grace, and find grace to help in time of need. Into God's temple, into God's throne room, there's a welcome sign. God's torn down the veil. We're in New Testament days. All these Old Testament things were important. They pictured some of the negative and some of the positive. Somehow we couldn't get to God, and somehow we would eventually get to God. There's pictures of Jesus, and there's pictures of the Old Testament darkness. And now we come to New Testament days, and we come to the book of Hebrews, where we're going to read in chapter 8 and chapter 9 of Hebrews some of the explanation there that's comparing the tabernacle to the temple of heaven. Let's read. Hebrews 8 and 1. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. Been talking for 7 chapters, and instead of going to sum things up, here's kind of the crux of everything we've been talking about. We have such an high priest. That's Jesus Christ. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne room of the majesty in the heavens. Now, the priest sits in the temple, and Jesus does. But where does it say the priest is sitting right here? In the throne room. And what do we understand about this? That Jesus is not only the high priest, he's the high king of heaven. He occupies both positions. He's the priest in the temple of heaven. He's the king in the throne room of heaven. So we've got such an high priest who's sitting in the throne room. A Levitical priest couldn't do that. And a king from the tribe of Judah couldn't go to the temple. We've got Jesus now who occupies both seats. He's still sitting on the mercy seat, but he's sitting on the throne. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. It's already described him in the throne room, but now it describes him in the true tabernacle. That's the place of worship. That's where the priest goes. So he's the king in the throne room, and he's the priest in the tabernacle. The high priest, such an high priest in the tabernacle. The true tabernacle, not that which represented the tabernacle. Oh, the tabernacle was real. It was true to that extent in the wilderness. But it wasn't the true tabernacle that it was pointing to. It was a picture of that, but it wasn't that. It was a shadow of that, but it wasn't the reality of it. We're talking about the real tabernacle, the heaven tabernacle, where there's such a high priest, Jesus Christ, is the high priest. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. We've been admiring the craftsmen that pitched that tent in the wilderness with the tools they had. How big God didn't even have to have tools? What do you reckon? How about he just kind of spoke that thing into existence? I don't know that, but I'm speculating. I can't imagine God spent too many days trying to figure out how to make that thing. He spent a whole lot more time telling Moses how to make the one Moses made, I'm sure, than he did making the one up there. He spoke in his word and made a tabernacle, I do believe, a true tabernacle, a heavenly temple. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, whereof it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. What did the Old Testament priest have to offer? The blood of lambs, the blood of goats, the blood of an oxen, the blood of a dove, a pigeon, a clean animal. But it was always something else's blood. It was animal blood. It wasn't Jesus' blood. as those priests, it says here in this verse, had to have something to offer, so this priest had to have something to offer. What priest? Such an high priest, Jesus Christ. Did he offer a lamb? Well, kind of. He offered the capital L Lamb of God now, didn't he? Who was that? That was him. Who was the priest? That was him. Who was the sacrifice? That was him. He's both priest and sacrifice. As the Old Testament priest had to have something to offer, this priest had to have something too. But an animal's blood wouldn't do it. The death of an animal wouldn't accomplish what needed to be accomplished. Only the blood and the death of the capital L Lamb of God, Jesus Christ, would take away the sin of the world. So he had to have something to offer, and that something was his own life. God had prepared a body for him, his own, to be offered by himself. He was the priest. He said, no man takes my life from me. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to take it up again. He's in full control as priest offering the lamb, and as lamb, the lamb willingly coming without opening his mouth to the altar, to the sacrifice. Every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, whereof it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest. He wasn't of the right tribe. He didn't fit the mold. He didn't have the right lineage. He didn't descend from Aaron. He wasn't a high priest as this world had high priest at that time. If he were on the earth, he would not be a priest. He's not a priest on the earth. He's a priest in the tabernacle not made with hands. If you were a priest on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, the family of Aaron, who serve under the example. They're just the example of the shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shown to thee on the mount. It's all a pattern. It's all a picture. It's all a shadow of the reality of the true tabernacle and the such an high priest and the capital L Lamb of God. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, Jesus Christ, the such an high priest, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant. Remember the Old Testament covenant? We read about it two or three times ago, where they promised, we'll do our part, God will obey your law. And they broke the covenant, not according to the old covenant, a new testament, a better covenant, which was established on better promises. Their promises, they lied. This is the God who cannot lie. This is the God who's promised eternal life. Eternal life, the God who cannot lie. It's certain. A better promise, a better covenant, a better high priest, a better tabernacle. Everything's better. Everything's just right. Chapter 9, verse 1. Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. There was a tabernacle made, we've read about that. The first wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, into that holiest of all. After the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer. That's what Aaron carried that in there when he would go on that one day a year. Had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant, the two tables of stone. And over it the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat. We've read about that. That's the Old Testament tabernacle, the place of worship for the Israelites in the wilderness. Now when these things were thus ordained, the priest went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. Every day he would light the lamp. Every day he'd put oil in the lamp. Every 7 days he'd change out the showbread on the table. Every day he would put incense on that incense altar so that the sweet incense would go up before the mercy seat. Continually doing the work in that first room. But into the second, that holiest of all, the holy place, the most holy place, but under the second went the high priest alone once every year, not without blood. He better be carrying the blood with him of the animal, which he offered for himself and for the heirs of the people, the Holy Ghost this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was yet standing. It was off limits. The way to God hadn't been shown. It wasn't known. You couldn't get where God was. There was a big keep out, no trespassing sign. Don't go in there lest you die. Whew. Aren't you thankful that you don't meet a no trespassing sign when you come to God these days? And there's not a veil that would separate. Remember who tore the veil? God did. The Holy Ghost this signifying that the way to God in those days was not yet known. What is the way to God? Let me rephrase. Who is the way to God? Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. Now, Jesus had been the way, clear back to Adam, it's just that they didn't know it. Jesus had been the way, but yet it was still off limits for them to come anywhere near the presence of Jesus. In the age of lack of understanding, before New Testament revelation is given, they're in the dark. The veil separates them from God. God tears down the veil. God gives us the revelation that which was covered in the Old Testament is now uncovered. The glory of God that was covered in the Old Testament is now wide open, and we can see Jesus through the eye of faith. Through coming boldly to the throne of grace and finding grace to help in time of need, to approaching a mercy seat and expecting not a lightning bolt, but mercy. We're seeing in a way the true God. Now the other was the true God too. God's a judge of sin, and that's real. And for thousands of years, Old Testament days, God was seen that way. Fear the judge. Now we're seeing God this way. Love the Savior. Sin's still real, but Jesus paid for it. And God took it serious, otherwise he wouldn't have sent his son. Now, sin matters, but Jesus made the difference for us. So we've got a new time now, and the Holy Ghost is signifying in the Old Testament days that the way to know God hadn't come to that point at that point. Verse 9. That Old Testament tabernacle, the first tabernacle, which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. It says in another place in Hebrews, if they'd ever felt like they'd been forgiven, they'd quit sacrificing. They'd just continually come in with sacrifices, begging for forgiveness, that God will move the sins back a little farther, and they never felt any peace. You know what understanding grace gives you? It gives you peace. You know what the revelation in New Testament times gives you? It gives you peace. It gives you real hope. It gives you a welcome sign to come to God. The religion of understood forgiveness, that's Christianity. But they never sensed that. Their consciences were never eased. They continually lived under guilt and a burden in bondage. Which stood on there, that sacrifice, that worship service, that worship arrangement in those days stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them from the time of Reformation. But Christ being come in high priest of good things to come. Christ being come a high priest, he's been here. By a greater and more perfect tabernacle, that true tabernacle in heaven, and made not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, not of anything made on the earth, neither by the blood of goats and calves, not by the blood of an animal or the death of an animal. Neither by the blood of goats and calves and the ashes of an heifer sprinkling the unclean, sanctifying the purifying of the flesh. Neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of an heifer sprinkling the unclean, sanctifying the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? New Testament times is not a time to be a freeloader. Yes, we've been set free and we have our liberty. But being set free, we've been brought under bondage to be servants of Jesus Christ. How much more should we be expected to do that with what we know if they were expected to do it with what they knew? To whom much is given, much is required. Free at last, but servants to Christ. Some kind of balance right there. That is true Christianity. Our Heavenly Father, we
Thank you for these pictures of your truths, and we ask forgiveness where we've not seen the real meaning and the true meaning, or even hardly a glimpse of it, Lord, but we've tried to see you in these things. You've told us that you're in the Old Testament scriptures, and that we can search them and find you. Help us to do that more, to do it better. Turn the books of Leviticus and those books that seem sometimes to be of little use to us. Help us to see Christ in those books, and seeing him, we'll have fulfilled the purpose of the book, to give him glory. Help us as we leave here to glorify Christ in our minds and our hearts. Help us to be willing servants, that we give of our time to you, Lord. Bless those who especially need you, who are suffering and struggling and sick, and have lost loved ones and facing death even now, perhaps. Bless our church, we do pray. Lead those to us that you'd see when, that we might do them good and them do us good. Forgive us where we fail. In Jesus' name.